listening to Living with ADHD and CPTSD, available on Apple and wherever you get your podcasts.
Everybody, and welcome to another episode of Living with ADHD and CPTSD. Today's episode is CPTSD, and we are going to talk about the window of tolerance, which is also known as the difference between hyper and hypoarousal. So I've got an article here that I'm going to read, and then I'm going to go into some information on my own experience, of course, as I usually do, and then perhaps something else about what we're discussing today. All right, so this is very important because often when we are feeling normal or we're feeling calm and grounded and we're not in a triggered state, we often have this, like, it's kind of like a nice, calm, like, level where things that occur that might be stressful or traumatizing or, you know, cause us to be exhausted or sad or anxious or pain, it can be within that tolerance window. But people who suffer from a lot of, like, to our CPTSD or PTSD and have suffered a lot of trauma, things that would be manageable for people who don't have CPTSD, this would be very all over the place, and where we would get into a constant, like, set of hyperarousal and then or constant hypoarousal feeling, and we'd be dissociated or completely triggered and just not ourselves. So I'm going to read this and then we'll go from there. All right. So, windows of tolerance. A term coined by Dr. Dan Siegel is now commonly used to understand and describe normal brain-body reactions. Especially following adversity, the concept suggests that we have an optimal arousal level when we are within the window of tolerance that allows for the ebb and flow, up and downs of emotions experienced by human beings. We may experience hurt, anxiety, pain, and anger that brings us close to the edges of the window of tolerance, but generally we are able to utilize strategies to keep us within this window. Similarly, we may feel too exhausted, sad, or shut down, but we generally shift out of this. Below is a diagram demonstrating the ebb and flow of an optimally regulated nervous system experiencing activation following bias settling. I will have this this link to this webpage, and you can take a look at it. It just shows a diagram of a healthy nervous system. When we experience adversity through trauma and unmet attachment, this can drastically disrupt our nervous system. Our senses are heightened, and our experiences and reactions are typically intensified, and strategies are less readily accessible to us. Adverse experiences also shrink our window of tolerance, meaning we have less capacity to ebb and flow and a greater tendency to become overwhelmed more quickly. Learning how to track and shift our effect can be a powerful tool for promoting regulation and integration throughout the brain's body and mind. Regarding arousal states, hyperarousal, calm arousal, and hypoarousal. Calm arousal is the ideal state in that most times during the day we fluctuate within various levels of calm arousal. However, when we become too overstimulated, fear, pain, anger, trauma triggers, etc., to the degree that it pushes us outside of a window of tolerance, this is hyperarousal. Hyperarousal is characterized by excessive activation energy, often in the form of anxiety, panic, fear, hypervigilance, and emotional flooding and such. This keeps our system stuck on and impacts our ability to relax, often making it difficult to sleep, eat, and digest food, and optimally managing our emotions. At the most intensified level, this may result in a dissociative rage or hostility. Hypoarousal may occur when we have too much hyperarousal, surpassing the pain and emotional overwhelm our brain body is able to tolerate, causing us to plunge into a state of hypoarousal, shutting down or dissociating. In this state, our system can become stuck on off, characterized by exhaustion, depression, flat effect, numbness, disconnection, dissociation, and such. This too impacts our sleep in that we may want to sleep all the time, and this impacts our appetite and digestion as well, and may make us feel emotionally deadened. Another diagram. All right. What I observed, however, is that as human beings, we have only have capacity to stay in one state for so long before the brain and body shifts us. For example, we can only tolerate so much pain, anxiety, and fear before the brain and body respond and numb us to this excessive energy. Similarly, people will only stay in a shutdown state, feeling emotionally deadened inside, before the brain body shifts us out of this, often by gravitating towards, and often subconsciously, things that make us feel alive. This could mean that what we gravitate towards, high-risk behaviors or activities uncharacteristic for us, to bring about that sense of excitement, activation, and vitality. Essentially, we are self-preserving as there is some part of the brain or body that is not ready to be dead yet. Many people will share that they don't feel right, are crazy, messed up, and such. They know that they don't feel okay, but without having experienced regulation in infancy and childhood or following unresolved traumatic experiences that remain activated in the brain and body, people may grow up in a manner that they don't know how to self-regulate. Instead, people often attempt to self-regulate and bring themselves into an optimal calm arousal level any way that they can, without even knowing this is what they are trying to do. For example, someone with excessive fear may gravitate towards a depressant to calm their brain and nervous system, whereas someone feeling emotionally deadened may gravitate towards a stimulant to make them feel alive. Excuse me. Understanding the function of how people are responding and what may be needed to effectively shift this emotional state is critical for finding effective strategies to shift arousal that don't lead to further harm to self or others, or leave the individual with a sense of shame. This can be referred to as a false refuge, in that it provides the illusion that it is helping, but in the end, the problem is still there and maybe even bigger, and now we have layered on shame, guilt, a sense of failure, and such. As we have responded in a way that we didn't want to, a true refuge is something we do for ourselves that effectively allows us to shift towards our optimal arousal zone while building competencies and taking care of ourselves in a manner that feels good. Parents, loved ones, and teachers or staff can help by identifying and labeling or making observations based on how children are presenting. It looks like you are feeling overwhelmed. Why don't we take a break? Dan Siegel refers to this as name it to tame it. Naming it allows for a sense of understanding and being seen as well as validation. When we stop to notice with ourselves or others, this can be a powerful grounding tool. Children, youth, and adults should be encouraged to focus mindfully on noticing how they feel, how their body feels, and identifying what they need to feel right again. Our goal is to essentially broaden this window of tolerance, increasing capacity for people to hold emotional experiences, even intense ones, without becoming dysregulated or going into a state of hyper or hypoarousal. Below is a great visual by NICABM to help understand this concept. Another diagram. When we understand where people are within this window of tolerance, it allows us to target treatment or teach them and their loved ones skills and strategies to effectively promote affect regulation. The function of the behavior is important to understand with compassionate curiosity. For example, for the person who is self-harming, are they self-harming because the pain they feel is so intense that the self-harming behavior is the only thing that provides release? Or are they doing so because they feel so emotionally deadened that they self-harm to feel alive? This can help to effectively target treatment. If we have too much discharging, the excess energy and intense emotions will often help to shift things. Think about it. This is precisely what happens when intense emotions build, then explode out of us through conflict or chaos. There is a release of emotional buildup, but it is messy and harmful for us and those around us. Instead, learning how to effectively release these intense emotions can be helpful. Similarly, if we are feeling shut down, using strategies to optimally stimulate our brain and nervous system in a healthy and empowering manner can shift us out of the state in a way that feels good for us. Okay. The key to figuring out what works and when. At times, some activities may be down-regulating or grounding, while at times the same activity may be stimulating. Try different things and find what works well for you. Practice strategies when you are calm and on a regular basis. This will build your capacity to access these when you start to become overwhelmed. If introducing activities to a client or loved one, it is important to monitor the effect of the individual you are working with and request feedback from them to notice how they are feeling. Sample activities to decrease arousal may include diaphragmatic breathing, drinking from a straw, throwing a therapy ball at a blank wall, jumping on a trampoline or mini trampoline, weighted blanket, warm water, shaking or stomping out excess energy, therapy, yoga ball, rolling along back when the child is flying face down on the mat. Heavy work like lifting, pulling, push-ups, wheelbarrow races, crab walk, leapfrog. Music, soothing and calming music and sounds, and then comforting food like hot chocolate or something chewy but smooth such as a Tootsie Roll. And then activities to increase arousal include anything that stimulates the senses, smelling essential oils. Smelling is the fastest way to the thinking brain where our strategies are. Chewy, crunchy food. Use a sensory shaker or like a ball pit for tactile input. Movement. Jumping on a trampoline. Gently sitting and bouncing on a therapy ball. Rocking chair. A weighted blanket. Finger painting. Water play with a straw, like blowing through the straw. And dancing and music. Elevated arousal makes it more likely that an individual will be more reactive, startle more readily, and have difficulty concentrating and focusing. Feel unsafe in open and crowded spaces or crowded spaces and constantly be scanning for threat even when there is no threat present. Okay. So, when providing support to others, it is important to recall that trauma is marked by a loss of control. Therefore, the ability to establish control and experience a sense of safety and empowerment is of priority in the face of real or perceived threat. Dan Hughes provides a great visual for this, demonstrating how warm touch, face, voice communicates with our amygdala to promote a sense of safety. I would suggest that this generalizes to all interactions when we are communicating with a soft voice, soft facial expression, gentle posturing, and gentle and welcome touch. This promotes a sense of safety and provides a calm, attuned presence. And you can increase empowerment and safety as follows. Respond in a right brain sensory rather than left brain level. Adjust the tone, volume, cadence of your voice, proximity, body posturing, and breathing to a level that will present as calm, helping to co-regulate the individual you are interacting with. Validate their emotions and offer to help them regulate. It looks like you are feeling angry. Would it be helpful if we, and then insert your strategy. Allow for choice and control. When in an activated state that is readily perceived and in fact assumed, this is why reactions are so often exaggerated. To reduce their arousal level, provide opportunity for them to do what they perceive as necessary to return to calm, like going for a walk or throwing a ball. Do not engage in behavioral and cause and effect approaches. If you do this, then these are higher function left brain responses and not something they are capable in the moment. Rather, this is likely to result in increased escalation. In a summary, learning how to shift your arousal level, the arousal level of your loved ones or those you work with, can be a powerful tool for promoting integration and building competencies. It can also lead to feeling more comfortable in one's own body and more confident in the ability to manage emotions and maintain relationships. So there we go. That's that article. Very interesting. I often have that problem, you could say. I'm often in a state of hyper-arousal. That's like hyper-vigilance, where you seem to be always on edge. You're easily, like, startled, you know? Like, you need to calm down. You know, like you're in a flight-fight response and, you know, you're feeling all like anxiety, you're feeling overwhelmed and you have chaotic responses or outbursts. And I do have a tendency when I am triggered to have emotional outbursts that are really odd. and chaotic responses. I do have a rigidness about it, and then I do get obsessive and compulsive behavior or thoughts. And then my impulsivity obviously goes up. And the funny thing is I also can do the other one. I can often get hypo-aroused. I dissociate, I'm not present, I'm shut down, there's memory loss, I get disconnected, I go on autopilot. There's like no emotional display, I'm flat, like a robot, and some separation from self and feelings and emotions. It's funny how that is very similar to having autism, but only in when you're in a bleh, when you're triggered or when you're feeling alarmed and threatened. All right, I'm going to take a break, and then when I come back, we will continue with this episode. All right. Here is something that I have found that I think will be of help. It's called Cultivating Resilience, 5 Steps to Help Cope with Triggers. So anybody who suffers from complex trauma and have been suffering for a long time, they often experience triggers. And of course, the triggers are a lot more likely to occur and be more like disastrous or harmful if they're often in a hyper arousal state, like I was saying earlier in my episode here. And so here are some steps that you can use to help cope with them. So number one is to know what your triggers are. Knowing what situations are likely to trigger you can help increase your sense of control. Number two is have a specific plan to regulate yourself. Once you know what your complex PTSD triggers are, come up with a coping plan. Think about what exactly you can do to regulate yourself. Three, tell your loved ones. Let the important people in your life know what you are doing and ask for their support. For example, one of my clients is a yoga teacher. She told her boyfriend and her parents that when she is triggered, she is going to step out for 15 minutes while she practices asanas, a calming breathing technique. And calming breathing techniques. Sometimes I just can't see that word. So they don't worry. She also agreed to return in 15 minutes, even if it's only to tell them she needs more time. 4, use your tools. Once you come up with a specific tool, then it becomes a matter of practice. Implement your calming techniques. And then 5, get into therapy with a specialist for CPTSD. They can guide you towards full recovery. Remember, if you have complex PTSD, traditional forms of therapy are likely to be inadequate. Men and women with complex PTSD do recover, and then chances improve greatly when you work with a therapist who is specializing in CPTSD. With the right tools and the right guidance, you can too. All right, so when you're someone who has a lot of triggers and you often deal with feeling overwhelmed and your anxiety and stress levels are high, you often have a very short window of tolerance. And when you do get triggered or you are feeling stressed, even if it's like a minor one, it doesn't have to be a major trigger either, you will feel all over the place. If it's pretty severe and you feel trapped or you feel like you aren't safe around anybody or anywhere you happen to be, your behavior can often become erratic and very unpredictable. Especially if you are very severe CPTSD, because you can be quick to temper, like to break up or not break up, like break out in a temperament, and you can, there are potential for some people who have CPTSD to be aggressive, violent, extremely angry. It's to like to the point where you just are, you're nothing like yourself. You know, you have all these symptoms and these signs of it. And if you haven't been really doing any therapy in the past to help deal with it and get through the processes and learn about why it's affecting you and, you know, learning of your parts, then you're going to have a very difficult time getting anywhere. And you're often going to cause a lot of further issues and complications, especially if somebody who you love is around and has a hard time dealing with the triggers, because they can offer their assistance and try to give you whatever it is you need. Like if you need space, if you need some time, if you need to be held, if you just need to listen to them while they rant, maybe they need to turn the music on inside the house nice and loud and kind of drown it out. A lot of times though, that is what is known as dissociating, or another way of putting it is zoning out. It becomes so overwhelming and so intense that you just don't want to deal with it, or you don't feel capable of experiencing and handling the trigger. So you get to the point where now all of a sudden you're going, I don't want to deal with this. This is just too much. And so you might like go and grab a giant bag of chips and turn on a movie or turn on a TV show and binge watch and like wear loose clothing and just cover up in a blanket and just sit on the chair and do nothing else. And you just want to allow your mind to be allowed to just roam around and not think about it. It is a coping strategy. It's not always healthy at sometimes, and people who are very inexperienced when it comes to, you know, working with their trauma and their triggers that they're having, it can definitely be harmful not only to them, but if they have a family, then it can be harmful to the family in an emotional way. And possibly, depending on the person, it could be even in a physical way. Because sometimes people who are dealing with a trigger don't realize in the moment what is going on. Sometimes they may not even know what's happening, like until after. And they may not have a memory of what happened, right? It's possible that they finally snap out of it, or they have finally been able to ground. And it's not from doing the work. It's just from zoning out or being dissociated. And eventually their system, and it's hard to say, there's no time frame, right? But it could be an hour, could be 30 minutes, it could be a few hours, it could be the entire day. And going to sleep and waking up the next morning, they feel better. But they might not remember much of anything of what happened. And if they are in a dissociated state, or they're numb, or they're basically like blank, they're not there much of anything, they're not going to remember much. Like the article stated, people who are in a hypoarousal state, if they're in extreme area of it, they will have memory issues where they won't remember pretty much anything that occurred. And in real extreme cases where a person has DID disorder and they completely dissociate to a different personality, both in a mental and a physical aspect, they're not going to remember anything. They're going to wake up. Either it'll end, or it won't, and they'll go to bed, and then they wake up, and they're like, they have no memories or no recollection of what happened that evening previous to them. And if someone can tell them, which it'd be helpful, but basically they need to get help. They need to find a way to get assistance from a therapist. A couple episodes ago, one of the most effective and my preferred method of therapy is the structural dissociation theory, because everything that's occurring, they don't necessarily say it in this article, but when you break it down and you actually look at it really deep and you really think about it, they're talking about child parts and the adult part. And when we get hyper arousal and we get stressed, we get triggered, the trigger is bringing a child part online. The child part is becoming activated, and what ends up happening is they do things and they say things that are not adult-like at all, and they end up becoming blended, like the adult is blended with the child part. And I have a lot of experience with this, obviously, where I have become triggered and I get blended with my parts, and I have no idea what's going on. I say things that are childish, and it's pretty clear that they are, like asking questions that like really a child would ask, or a person who's triggered would be asking. And when they think about it and they look back and they go, oh yeah, that was a childish comment, that really wasn't necessary. It's that kind of thing that really isn't healthy for that person. This is where they need to get proper therapy, like using the structural dissociation theory would be extremely helpful in showing this person a path towards healing and towards less triggers and a much better recovery time and mode, and the ability to properly process with these parts that have experienced the trauma. Because you're having a flashback, basically, right? Like I've discussed this in other episodes multiple times. You're having your flashback and you're feeling threatened and you're feeling alone and you're not feeling safe by any means. And the child parts, of course, are protecting you because they feel that your life is in danger. And they have good reason to, because for many of us, probably a large percentage of us, when we were a child, we were often in danger. Our lives often felt, you know, under threat of possible death or harm or abuse. Like we were, like many people who have CPTSD were abused as a child, of course. And so they experienced neglect. They probably, or they could have been brought up by a narcissist or like both of their parents, obviously. And so, of course, as they grow up and they at some point maybe move out and go to college, or they maybe have their own family, something begins that trigger to this past trauma that they've experienced. And now their behavior changes. They're getting blended with these child parts and they're not themselves. And like I said earlier, when you're having that hypoarousal state, and you're feeling numb and you're feeling blank and you're feeling flat and you don't have any emotion and you're basically dissociating, this is what happens, like I said, when it's just too difficult. It's way too intense for a person to handle. And they end up using this as a method to allow themselves to get relief. it's not a bad thing. Dissociating can be healthy if all you ever are experiencing is a constant state of hypervigilance, or you're always living in survival mode and you don't feel safe, you never feel like you can relax or feel comfortable in your location or in your situation that you're in and feel grounded. So it's a healthy way to be. But one thing you do have to know and understand is that at some point you do have to look to get like therapy to start your healing, to move towards not having to be dissociated so often. It's not a good thing in a long-term state because it affects things like your relationships. It can affect your work. It can affect family. You know, it's very dangerous in a long-term plan, but in the short term, it is a good way of avoiding feeling the stress and the anxious feelings and the triggers that are very dangerous, or your parts feel that are there protecting you because there are dangerous situations. But therapy is clearly the key here to moving beyond this. A lot of work and a lot of therapy can go a long way if you find the right therapist, like it said in the article. So yeah, the window of tolerance is different for everybody, of course, as we are aware of. And a healthy person with a healthy level of stress and anxiety will be able to come out of this on a regular basis, face that fear, face that stress, and then recover and move on. Whereas someone who's faced triggers and trauma as a child repetitively, it's going to be very difficult to be able to manage the stress and not get triggered and end up having childlike reactions or harmful and dangerous reactions that could be very, very unpleasant and very inappropriate. Okay, well, that's it for today's episode. It's a bit of a shorter one compared to some of the ones that we've done or that I have done lately, but it's a pretty straightforward concept here for this episode. It was an easy one to talk about, but it was a good time to bring it up and discuss it. If you have any questions, you can ask me. You can go to my Twitter account. It's at ADHD and CPTSD. You can go to my website, www.livingwithadhdandcptsd.ca, and you can contact me there. And I would be more than happy to talk, and we can go and discuss whatever you feel like when it comes to CPTSD. I would love it if you guys would donate to my cause to help me maintain my podcast, as I do pay for the software that I use to create these. So if you really enjoy these podcasts and they are helpful for you or for somebody that you know, go to ko-fi.com, ko-fi.com, and look for Living with ADHD and CPTSD. And you can donate a monthly amount or a one-time amount. And I would greatly appreciate either of them. All right, that's it. Come back next week for more episodes and have a great weekend. Bye, everyone.